I'm delighted to be able to introduce this morning's speaker. Professor Joel E. Baker is the Port of Tacoma Chair in Environmental Science, and he's a professor at the University of Washington, Tacoma. He received his bachelor's degree in environmental chemistry from the State University of New York in Syracuse, and he received his master's and PhD in civil and environmental engineering from the University of Minnesota. And he was on the faculty at the University of Maryland in their Center for Environmental Sciences Chesapeake Biological Laboratory. He's done a lot of really fascinating work on the Chesapeake Bay that we're so fortunate to have him here and bring his expertise to study the problems of Puget Sound. I would also say that we were able to, well, see the University of Washington, and we were able to entice him away to be able to come and now hold the endowed chair at the University of Washington, Tacoma. He's also the chair of the Puget Sound Partnership Panel, and he has an endowed chair for the Center for Urban Waters in Tacoma. Some of his interests you'll hear about during this talk. He's been working in transport of organic contaminants in the atmosphere and in surface waters. He's worked closely with state and regional management agencies in giving them analytical and modeling support for understanding the environmental assessments and the consequences of their actions. He teaches graduate level courses in water quality modeling. He's co-authored over 80 papers on contaminant cycling in Great Lakes and Chesapeake Bay and coastal waters. And some of his many accomplishments, he was a member of the National Research Council's Committee on Oil and Sea. He chaired the New York, New Jersey Harbor Contaminant Assessment and Reduction Program's Model Evaluation Group. He's advised the European Commission on Water Quality Modeling, and he's also served on the Board of Directors of the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry, so impressive list of accomplishments. With that, let's offer a warm and enthusiastic welcome to Dr. Joel Baker.
Thank you, Ann. Good morning. Can you all hear me okay?
It's working okay.
Super. Well, thanks to all of you for getting up so early in the morning. I realize it's a requirement of your class now, so I realize why you're all here. But it's a real pleasure to be here. I'm only about 2.5 months or 3 months into living on the West Coast, and it's been a real delight getting to know people here. What I want to talk about today is an example of the law of unintended consequences. Often in environmental science, particularly in water quality, we end up getting ourselves into a situation that is caused by our attempt to do something to the good. And the example that I'll give here is flame retardants. Just out of curiosity, can you raise your hand if you've ever heard of flame retardants? Most people. Okay, good, cool. So we're going to talk a little bit about it. But, of course, flame retardants are in the environment because they're in our consumer products. They're in the laptops. They're in your Blackberries, all these things Ann just told you to turn off. All contain flame retardants, and they do that because we're trying to prevent people from catching on fire. So there's a clear benefit to society of having these chemicals at least in our products, because it prevents fire, which is a major risk factor in our daily lives. However, these chemicals are ending up in the environment, as we'll talk about in today's talk. So we need to think more carefully about the risks associated with those. In particular, I'm going to focus on a class of chemicals called the there's actually a typo on my slide. It's decabromodiphenyl ether. Anyone catch that except me? Jeez, I've given this talk like 3 times and never knows that. It's a brominated compound. It's not a chlorinated compound. Sorry about that. Decabromodiphenyl ether is a compound that we're going to spend most of the lecture talking about. So, with that introduction, let me just say a few words about where I am, because I know that those of you in the University of Washington, Seattle, think that you're the main campus. Actually, the main campus is in Tacoma. We have... I've met people down here. Sure. How many people have been to Tacoma? Most people, yeah. Bars, concert, music, driving through on your way to Olympia. So Tacoma, we're about 3,000 undergraduates now. It's primarily an undergraduate institution, although we have desires to grow into the graduate training as well. It's the home of the famous bridge. That's the new one. The old one fell down. If you're a civil engineer, you've seen the movie of the old bridge that was not designed properly and fell down. It's also home of the Tacoma Dome, which is the largest wood dome structure in existence. It also fell down halfway through construction. So if you're a construction civil engineering type, you should come to Tacoma, because that's where all the lessons learned are. And also mentioned the Center for Urban Waters, which is a new initiative in the city of Tacoma, really driven by the local business and civic community. This is the architect's renderings of a building that will be built on the Thea Foss Waterway right in downtown Tacoma that will house the Center for Urban Waters. We'll hope to break ground around the 4th of July and be in it by next fall. The Center for Urban Waters is, I think, very similar in mission and quite compatible with the Water Center here. We're interested in issues related to urbanization impacts on the environment, particularly impacts on water quality. So when you come to Tacoma next fall, you'll see this building, and my office is up in the corner there, I hope. So this talk was really, the science of the talk was done by my graduate students, as is always the case. So I want to thank Heather Stapleton, Susan Klosterhaus, who are both PhD students in my lab at Maryland. Heather's now at Duke, and Susan is at the San Francisco Estuary Institute. Erin Dreis was an undergraduate who worked with Susan. She's an RU student from South Dakota. And my collaborator on this is Rob Letcher, who's a toxicologist at the University of actually moved to the University of Ottawa, but he was at the University of Windsor. So the work that we do, the kinds of chemicals that my group studies, all have these common characteristics. Where's my magic pointer here? They're organic chemicals. They tend to be dominated by anthropogenic sources, although many of them, PAHs are a good example, have natural sources as well. The important part of it is that they're sufficiently persistent and mobile that they're transported in the environment regionally to globally. So we now find these chemicals in the Arctic. They got in the Arctic by volatilizing in the atmosphere and being carried by the winds. They're persistent, they're hydrophobic, so they accumulate in food webs. So they're in you, they're in me, they're in animals. And they're, in some cases, human toxicants. So we're interested in these things really because they stick around long enough that they can get transported to where we live, and they end up in our food, and then they end up in us. So many of these chemicals, going back 30, 40 years, if you think about DDTs and PCBs and dioxins and all these things that you may have heard about, we've been very successful in controlling the production and emissions of these chemicals. This is a graph of DDT. DDT was an insecticide, the focus of the Rachel Carson book. This is a really nice monitoring program run by the Swedes, and the Swedes really do science well in this regard. And this is human breast milk samples collected from 1970 to 1995. And so they've had this long-term monitoring program where they sample milk, analyze it for a whole variety of industrial chemicals. This is the concentration of DDT in nanograms per gram lipid of milk, decreasing, nice exponential decline in DDT in humans in Sweden. And this is clearly a cause and effect of banning the use of DDT in Europe in the late 70s, and the concentrations declined precipitously. This is a real success story. If you look at exactly those same samples and you analyze a different class of chemicals, you get this answer. The blue dots are polybrominated diphenyl ether concentrations in the same samples. So they archive the breast milk samples. They can go back and analyze them after the fact. You can see quite clearly that in the 1970s there were undetectable levels of flame retardants in human breast milk because they weren't produced yet. Once these things went into production, you see a nice exponential, a classic exponential rise, doubling times of on the order of a few years, rapid increases in concentrations of these chemicals in humans. This is the graph that launched 1,000 research studies and regulatory action. This is really, really quite alarming. So that's what got us into this game in the first place. So what are these compounds, these flame retardants, polybrominated diphenyl ethers, PBDEs is the name. Here's the structure, right? So it's a diphenyl ether, right, to benzene rings joined by an ether linkages, and then a variety of number of bromines on them. And they were produced as commercial mixtures. So there's a mixture called penta, which is mostly penta. Clever industry names. Octa, mostly octa. And then this compound we're going to focus on, which is deca, in which all of the possible sites are brominated. And the way these things work is really quite simple. If you put these in products and you put a flame underneath, you hold a flame underneath your couch, what happens is these bromine atoms are fairly labile, so the bromine kicks off and scavenges the free radicals out of the flames. And it prevents things from flaming. It doesn't prevent them from smoking. smoldering, but things won't flame up. So really all this is a backbone on which you can hang bromines that can be released. And you can see the different formulations are used in different products. And there's a whole bunch of different compounds here. Okay. So why do we need the flame retardants in the first place? Well, we need flame retardants because the state and federal law requires that there's flame resistance to consumer products. Automobiles, computers, upholstered furniture. These don't have any upholstered furniture. Carpets, curtains. These curtains probably have flame retardants in them, depending on how long they were hanging here. So the industry doesn't put these chemicals in there just for the heck of it. Right? They're required to do this. This is the way they meet the flammability standards. When you buy a couch, there's a standard set of tests that it's gone through to verify that couch meets a minimum flammability standard. So the reason the chemicals are out there is because the regulatory agencies require this level of protection. And there's a whole bunch of different ways the chemists have come up with of getting flame retardancy in consumer products. And this is just, you can do it with aluminum. Actually, aluminum oxide powder impregnated into things prevents them from flaming. There's compounds with phosphorus and antimony and chlorine. But most of one of the most popular ways of doing it are these brominated compounds. And there's a whole bunch of these that are on the market right now. Things like, let me just say that and there's two kind of broad flavors, so you can't read these names, but these are just a whole bunch of brominated compounds. The ones in green are the brominated diphenyl ethers. And there's kind of two ways that this works. One is these additive BFRs are just coated on materials. So this is a product that's sprayed on to foam, for instance, in your couch. So these are just, the chemicals are just kind of adsorbed or sitting on the surface of the products, fairly labile to getting released in the environment. The reactive brominated flame retardants, things like tetrabromyl bisphenol A, are actually chemically bound into the plastics, so they're thought to be at least more resistant to release from the environment. Okay? But the point here is there's a whole bunch of these things. And because of the demand for flame, for fire protection, and because of the rapid increase in electronic industry, by and large, this is the temporal trend in production of these brominated compounds. Again, these things really weren't around until the early 1990s, more or less, and they really came into their own and sort of took off exponentially. So the blue line is the decachloro BDE, and just to give you a sense, there's something on the order of 50 or 60,000 metric tons of the stuff produced annually, and about half of it's used in North America. Read that as the United States. Okay. And again, these are used for different things. The different commercial formulations, this penta mixture was used in the flexible foam in your cushions. DECA is used almost entirely in this stuff, the high impact polystyrene that's in your computers and television cases and things of that nature is what the DECA is used for. So different compounds, different uses. These compounds, these mixtures contain different components. These are really hydrophobic chemicals. This is the log octanol water partition coefficient, 10 to the 7th, 10 to the 8th DECA. Brominated diphenyl ether has the highest KOW I've ever seen. It's 10 to the 10th. That's a huge number. DDT is about 10 to the 5th or so. So it's 5 orders of magnitude more hydrophobic than DDT. So once the Swedes reported that data, a lot of other people went out and looked at archived records. This is concentration of these compounds in herring gall eggs from the Great Lakes. Again, very little concentration, but increased rapidly in the 90s and to present time. Concentration Columbia River whitefish from a study, only 3 points here, but this is continued. Same story. So these things, once they're produced, they were released into the environment quite rapidly. This is from the West Coast, a study of these brominated diphenyl ethers in San Francisco harbor seals. This is a log scale concentration of these compounds in the seals. Again, these are archived samples that we went back and reanalyzed. This you see from 1990 to 2000. Straight line on a log scale, so it's an exponential increase in the concentration of these compounds in the harbor seals in San Francisco Bay, and presumably elsewhere. These compounds are also detected in the atmosphere. This is a monitoring program, again, in the Great Lakes from a paper by Ron Heitz's group. So different, this is downtown Chicago, places in more remote areas of the Great Lakes. The red bar is the brominated diphenyl ether concentrations. Still pretty low, this is a log scale, still pretty low, but measurable in the ambient air out in the middle of the, you know, the open Great Lakes. And what this means is these compounds are being transported globally in the atmosphere. Okay. The other interesting thing about this is that the concentrations that we're seeing in the environment scale to the use and production of these compounds. Remember, well, the first slide I showed you was the increased concentration in the breast milk in the Swedish monitoring program. Those data are, I'll get this on, are the red dots. So this is time series again, concentration in breast milk samples. These are the red dots. The black line are the North American samples. Okay, there's fewer data because the Swedes do it all the time and the U.S. government does it whenever they're forced to do it. So. Any government employees here? Okay. This scales, there's about a factor of 10 difference in the use of these compounds in North America versus Europe. And it scales almost exactly to the concentrations you see in humans. Okay, so that works. So that really rapid increase you see there is lost in the noise. We're blowing that out of the water in North America. And you can see that here. This is just, again, a number of biological samples of human tissue samples. So this is mother's serum and the umbilical cord serum. So this is a pregnant women at right after they've given birth. This is the concentration of these flame retardants in their blood versus what's transferred to the fetus in North America, and then in Sweden, again, log scale, so almost two orders of magnitude difference in concentration between the two. And the important point of this is that there is maternal transfer, that these compounds are in mothers and they're transferred to the fetus. This is just a number of pairs, so this is mother-child pairs, concentrations in the mother and concentrations in the fetus, and there's a really high correlation. So these compounds, if they're in the adults, they get transferred to the child. The other interesting thing about it, on the left-hand side, this graph, these are the different components of the industrial mixture, and without getting into the details of it, the blue bars are the lower brominated congeners. This is sort of what you buy when you buy the commercial product. If you look at the concentrations either in fish or in humans, it's enriched in the lower brominated congeners and depleted in the heavier brominated congeners. And this is consistent with our understanding of the pharmacokinetics of this, that these compounds that are highly hydrophobic don't accumulate as efficiently as the lower brominated compounds because of mass transport limitations. So they're out there, they're getting into humans. Do they have any effect? Well, this is pretty... there's increasing evidence that there's biological effects. There's a whole variety of studies at fairly high dosage level showing neurobehavioral thyroid effects, some evidence of carcinogenicity of these compounds. These things also break down in humans to form hydroxylated compounds, so a bromine pops off and a hydroxyl group gets put on. And these are concerned for this reason. If you look at right now circulating in your bloodstream are these two compounds, T3 and T4. This is basically your thyroid system. And you can see that these are has this structure with the iodine halogen groups stuck here and here in this hydroxyl group. The concern is that if you hydroxylate these brominated diphenyl ethers, this part of it looks awful lot like this part. Right? This is a natural compound. This is essential to your functioning of your thyroid system. And the studies now have shown that this thyroid-like hydroxylated BDEs competitively binds with the transport proteins in your bloodstream and messes up your thyroid system. Okay, so that's kind of the background on the toxicity. So where do these things come from? These things come from everywhere because they're in all of our consumer products. We think, and I'll skip over this real quickly, I think the major route of exposure for humans is through dust. And we know this because if you go out and sample dust in your house, the concentrations of flame retardants, this is the sampling that Heather Stapleton in my lab did, it's actually my house, the concentrations of flame retardants in the dust swept up off the floor is on the order of 30 micrograms per gram dry weight, which is a huge concentration relative to environmental levels. So we really think that, you know, at least my view of this is that the exposure to humans of this brominated diphenyl ether stuff is mostly about exposure to dusts and having dust in your food and inhalation and particularly for children eating dirt. So if we think about analogies to other environmental issues, it's probably more similar to the lead exposure story for children, childhood exposure to lead from days gone by, probably more so than a bioaccumulation into fish and meats and things of that nature. So that's kind of where we are with what we know about flame retardants. The question our group has been asking is, how do these things behave in aquatic ecosystems, and how do they accumulate in aquatic organisms? So I want to spend the rest of the time talking about the studies that we've done. At the time, before we started this work, the paradigm was that the decabromodiphenyl ether was so large, so hydrophobic, as industry said, it's like a rock. It's not going to. They wish they had never said that. It's not going to break down. It's not going to accumulate. It's entirely inert. And usually, when someone tells you that, you should be suspicious, and you'll see why in a minute. So, a little bit about fish. So, you have fish swimming in the water. We put in brominated diphenyl ether. It can either take it up by eating contaminated prey. It can take it up by exchanging across its gills. Once the chemical gets into the fish, of course, it can be metabolized into other products. It can be excreted, or it can accumulate. So we always start with field evidence. This is data from Ron Heitz's lab, where they went out to collect fish. And the curious thing about this is, so we'll start in. This is a lake, Hadley Lake. This is the concentration of the brominated diphenyl ether congeners in the sediment of the lake. Okay, and it doesn't matter what they are; these are individual compounds. The brown bar is this decabromodiphenyl ether. Okay, and as you can see, most of the flame retardant in the sediment is this form. But if you catch a fish from that lake, there's no detectable levels of decabromodiphenyl ether in the fish. Curious, eh? So most of it's, the exposure is this, but you don't see that. And this is the evidence that the argument was made then, well, this stuff is not bioavailable. There's no risk of decabromodiphenyl ether because, look, it doesn't accumulate. See? Turns out this lake, Ron, anybody know Ron Heitz, Indiana University? Big time chemist. He also has a good sense of humor. This lake is the lake in front of the corporate headquarters of the company that makes decabromodiphenyl ether in North America. Ron always has a good way of doing things. So Heather Stapleton in my lab, took on this issue of, does the decabromodiphenyl ether accumulate? What do we know about these things? So we worked with the common carp, which is just because it's a good lab rat in the lab, easy to culture and all that kind of stuff. And she did what you normally would do. We grew these fish, exposed them both in their diet and in the water to different BDE congeners, and then over time sacrificed them, looked at concentrations in the liver and in the tissue and in the bloodstream and all the normal kind of stuff you would do, and measured then the rate of uptake of different compounds, different brominated diphenyl ethers with time, right? So we'll start with something we know. Here, this top panel, so this is time of exposure on this axis out to 110 days or so, 120 days. These are polychlorinated biphenyls, which is kind of the thing we know the most about. We've been doing PCB uptake for many, many years. Very well behaved chemicals. They don't biotransform very, very quickly. And what you can see is that you get this nice increase in PCB accumulation in a fish, as you'd expect. After 60 days, then we just fed them clean food to see if the chemicals would persist. You get a little bit of depuration of PCBs, but really not very much. In contrast, the brominated diphenyl ethers, some of them behave like PCBs. They're taken up, and then they plateau and look sort of like a classic bioaccumulation model. Other things, like this BDE-153, is taken up much more slowly. The slope is less. And then when you cut it off, it depurates very quickly. Okay. So the different congeners are behaving differently. And we're able to calculate then what fraction of the exposure to the fish is accumulated in the fish. So again, for PCBs, typically what you find is about 40 or 50% of what you eat is incorporated into your tissues, and the other half comes out the other end. For PCBs, it's 30, 40% assimilation efficiency. For the lower brominated congeners, we get a widely variable assimilation efficiency. And for the heavier brominated congeners, we get almost no assimilation at all. Okay? So the question is there reactions going on in the fish tissue that account for some of this? So I should have said, see, this BD47, we get a 93% assimilation efficiency. That's almost unheard of. If all of it is being assimilated in the tissue. But for the BDE-99, we're not getting any assimilation, which is weird. Right? Because these two compounds have pretty similar physical properties. So something's going on there. So here's what we think was going on. This is BDE-99, this compound that was not assimilated. If you take off that bromine through some biological process, you end up with BDE-47. So we're converting one industrial chemical into another industrial chemical in the fish. Okay. So to test that, we challenged the fish with just pure BDE-99. We spiked worms with BDE-99. This is the concentration in food that was fed to the fish. We measured the gut contents of the fish to confirm that they actually ate the worms that had the BDE in it. And then 4 days after exposure, sure enough, there's no 99, this compound, parent compound, in the fish, but there's a lot of this BDE-47. We didn't give them any 47. They made the 47 internally from the 99. So that was the first time it was demonstrated that these fish can debrominate these compounds. And this is just the kinetics of that. I'm going to skip that. And it's not just that one particular pair of compounds. This wasn't just a kind of unique situation. This is another compound, BDE-183. Same story. We fed it to the fish. It's in the food. It's in the gut. Doesn't accumulate. Is there any risk? Doesn't accumulate. There's no risk, right? Well, wait a minute. It's creating another brominated compound within the gut. Okay, so that was for the lower brominated congeners. And about the time we were doing that work, those commercial products were phased out of the market because they were showing up in the Arctic, they were showing up in humans, and it was a bad enough story that they just phased them out of the market altogether. But they really fought to keep BDE-209 because that was most of the market share. And they said, well, BDE-209 is a different story, completely different compound, and won't accumulate. So we said, well, what about that? So what we did the same kind of study. We took this brominated compound. So these are gas chromatographs. Detected with mass spectrometry. So this is the chromatogram of the food, one big peak, right? This is that decabromodiphenyl ether coming out right there. A little bit of impurity of but really not very much. And none of the lower brominated congeners are in the food. This is a fish that's been eating this stuff for 10 days. Again, doesn't accumulate the deca, but you start to see all this other stuff growing in, these other compounds growing in. And this continues for 60 days. Again, no BDE, very good detection limits. It would be, if it was there, we could find it. But all these other lower brominated compounds are occurring. And so we presented this, and they said, well, you must have contamination in your lab. This stuff's just coming from somewhere else. So here's the control fish, a little bit of stuff, but doesn't account for that accumulation. So sure enough, if you expose fish to this compound, over time, these other compounds, some of which we know, some of which we don't know their exact structure, began to accumulate, and we can work out the kinetics of all that. Okay. So the bottom line on the fish story is that the fish convert something on the order of about 1% of the decabromodiphenyl ether that they ingest into other brominated compounds. Okay. Now, 1% doesn't sound so bad, right? It's 99% like a rock and 1% like something else. The problem is that there's so much of this stuff used that we're getting part per million levels of this decabromodiphenyl ether in sediments. So at part per million levels, you don't need to convert very much of it in order to have a pretty substantial accumulation in fish and shellfish. Okay. So it's an analogous story to DDT. Most of you are too young to remember DDT, but DDT was converted to DDE. DDT itself is not that harmful to wildlife is the DDE, the metabolite that was causing the problem. Right? Same issue, I think, is going on here, where we're converting a fairly non-bioavailable chemical into something that does accumulate. So that's the fish, and then we follow up on that. We said, well, what about the benthic organisms? Because all the diphenyl ethers are ending up in the mud. What are the worms doing? Can the worms access this material? So this is Susan Klausterhaus's work. PhD. She wrote this very nice PhD proposal called The Bioaccumulation of Decabromodiphenyl Ether in the Worms. Spent about 3 years convincing herself that decabromodiphenyl ether doesn't accumulate in worms. It's always traumatic when a student's proposal doesn't fit their hypothesis. It's good, but it's traumatic for them. It's fun for me. From a distance, you know, it's a little bit of perspective. She laughs about it now. So you all know about bioavailability from sediments. This is a big issue because we regulate, you know, the main route of exposure for many of these persistent chemicals is they accumulate in sediments and they get into the benthic infaunal organisms then translated through the food web. So that's what that says. So what do we know about DECA? There had been some previous studies about this compound. The Swedes always do stuff first and usually better. They did some studies with earthworms because this BDE-209 ends up in sewage sludge, which is then applied to agricultural fields. So they showed that earthworms accumulated BDE-209 from agricultural soils in this study.
Rob Hale's group in Virginia has done some studies, again, with biosolids added to soils, and they detected just a very, very small amount of bioaccumulation of DECA. Most other studies, this thing is not the easiest thing in the world to measure, so a lot of the early studies on this, the analytical problems kind of compromised their ability to say anything, including some of our earlier studies. You know, we have in Chesapeake Bay, we have DECA up to about 4 parts per million in sediments and near the sewage treatment plants, and yet the worms that we collect have no detectable levels of DECA after several years of trying to get them to take up DECA. So it doesn't look like it's available, but then the question becomes, is there transformations? So we did some laboratory experiments where we took clean worms, exposed them to, this is Baltimore Harbor sediments, which is sort of our Duwamish River analog, a very contaminated area, and did sort of a standard uptake experiment, similar to what we did for the fish. And what similar results to the fish is that, you know, the lower brominated compounds are taken up by the organism just fine. Now, this is concentration versus time over a 60-day period. If we allow for depuration, so these samples are put in clean sediment, that there's depuration for some of the compounds, but not all of the compounds. Again, the important point is the BDE was not detected in the field in these samples. So why is that? And there's a whole, a lot of discussion about why BD can be available. The options are really threefold. Here's the compound adsorbed onto the sediment that's ingested by the organism. So there's three possibilities here. Either the desorption rates are horribly slow, that the BD is hooked into black carbon or something like that. Or that there's competition, so there's only so much micelles within the gut juices of these organisms and the BD can't compete. Or it's so large that the transfer from the within the gut through the gut wall is slow. So we don't really know. We actually think this competition is probably the best idea for reasons I don't have time to go into. But you know, we're not really sure what the underlying mechanism limiting the bioavailability of these compounds are. The main idea here is that we know that other compounds are taken up through the gut by this process, but the BD209 is not taken up. So the next thing that Susan tried to do, but she was really determined to get BD209 into these animals so she could graduate. So the most, you know, the easiest thing, the most bioavailable form is to spike the compounds into the sediment and then expose them to the worms right away. That's the most thought to be the most bioavailable form. So she did that, and this is a bit of a mess, but where's BD209 is? The green dot, after 28 days, she finally got one measurable value of BD209 above the blanks, and with all the controls, she finally did it. She got 209 into the worms. So that she could measure the uptake rate constant, which is there. These are the uptake rates, first order uptake rates for all the different congeners versus their octanol water partition coefficient. 10 to the 10th, so it was measurable. Very small, but measurable. That's just the other compounds for comparison. This is the biota sediment accumulation factor. And this is kind of what regulatory agencies use. Just the ratio of the concentration of the chemical in the organism to the divided by the concentration in the mud. So and these are different compounds. So, you know, like, so 0.2 is 20%. So for BD209, the BSAF is like 0.00 something or other. It's a very, very small number. So what that all means to us is that the BDE209 is not accumulating in the benthic organisms to any significant extent in the field under realistic conditions. However, it is breaking down in the environment. There's been other studies done now showing that there's microbial debromination in the sediments. There's other processes that cause this 209 to break down. So again, the model is we've charged up the sediments with this chemical, and it's likely to slowly degrade over time into more bioavailable and probably more accumulating compounds. So less than 1% of the BDE is assimilated, but there's a lot of it out there. So in the little bit of time I have left, let's talk about where the future lies here, because a lot of these brominated compounds are being phased out of the market. So I mentioned earlier that when the Swedish study came out, this penta BDE was the major industrial major commercial product, let's say. And this was used in polyurethane foam. Production ceased in 2004, and California has regulated this. So really, the penta market went away. It was switched to other things. Octa was used in thermoplastics, but really was never a very large fraction of the market. They switched to DECA pretty quickly. And this has also been seen. So penta and octa commercial products are no longer produced anywhere. The good thing about this is this is only produced by one company in North America, so if they decided to quit, then there was no more production. The DECA is still being produced. There's no restrictions in California currently. It was banned in Washington, see the footnote, and in Maine. And just last week was banned in the European Union. The EU did a major risk assessment on DECA and concluded that it should be banned. So let's talk about Washington State. Last year the legislature passed a ban on DECA. It was the first ban in the country. There was great fanfare. However, the devil's in the details. What actually the state of Washington did was it banned DECA in mattresses. It says in the legislation, no DECA in mattresses. DECA was never used in mattresses. So this is an example of a little sleight of hand on the part of somebody. So they banned something that didn't exist, so congratulations. And then it says, banned in televisions, computer, and residential upholstered furniture by 2011 as long as a safer, reasonable, and effective alternative has been identified. So there's the wiggle words right there. So if there's no alternative, then they can keep doing it. So, congratulations. I mean, I'm not minimizing the importance of the ban. It's important to get it into the public discussion, but it's not as concrete as a lot of people think that it is. So where are we going beyond that? This has been a bit of a moving target because there's, as I said earlier, really all you need to do is have some framework onto which you can hang bromine atoms, and there's lots of different ways of doing that. So potential replacements for DECA are things like tetrabromobisphenol A, hexabromocyclododecane, decabromophenylethane, all these things. It turns out that, is that on the next slide? Let's see. Yeah. So the European Union, they banned DECA, or they banned the penta products a long time ago when they first came out. And as a consequence, they thought that their levels of BDEs went down quite rapidly in the environment and humans, and they were quite smug about this. What actually happened was that they switched from the penta the bromodiphenyl ethers. They switched to one of these other guys. Let's see, it was on the last slide. This guy, hexabromocyclododecane. Okay. So that was the replacement. It turns out the hexabromocyclododecane is a heck of a lot more toxic than the brominated diphenyl ethers. So although they were successful in driving the BDE levels down, I'm not sure they were successful in driving the risk down. So be careful what you ask for. So here's a whole laundry list, and this is just the ones we know about that are now in the marketplace that are being phased in to replace the brominated diphenyl ethers. Unfortunately, there's no requirement that the production volumes are released. There's no very little testing done on bioaccumulation, persistence, ecotoxicology, or human tox on any of these compounds. See all the question marks. Each one of these is a PhD dissertation waiting to be written. But these things are in the market now, and we really don't understand what they're doing. So a lot of work to be done. The story here is that the risk assessment of this is really this trade-off between flame protection, trying to keep our houses and businesses from burning down, versus the environmental and human health impacts. And there's certainly ways we can have both, but the response has been to just keep adding more and more different types of chemicals, and because it's not reported what they are, it takes us a while to catch up and detect them in the environment. So lots of work yet to be done. So I think that's all I have. Stop there. We have time for some questions. That's good. And I thank you for your attention. Is that Heather way in the back?
You want to start with students or outsiders?
Which one are you?
Okay, so
you should introduce yourself.
I'm Heather Jones, People from Puget Sound, and we are working on this issue of these toxic chemicals in Puget Sound. And my question is, I'm hearing from some people that the main way we are being exposed today to PBDs and PBDs is our diet from fish. So what do you say to the relative
Yeah.
How are they getting into orbit?
Okay. So the two questions, the first question is, what is the relative importance of your diet versus household dusts and other things today? My view of that is that it's that the household dust exposure is more important than food, but others have different views. The best evidence is that in the few studies that have been done, there are, the evidence is that the concentrations are usually higher in children than they are in adults, which argues against a bioaccumulation, long-term, chronic, sort of a classic dioxin type of accumulation, a lifetime integrated exposure. Concentrations are higher in people who have upholstered furniture and carpets and things in their houses than they are in people who have wood floors and that kind of stuff. They're higher in occupationally exposed people. Your computer guys, the IT guys, usually have the highest, guys is a gender-neutral term. The people who work on your computers, that dust on the inside of your computers that gets all over you, is loaded with this stuff. So there's been studies done on electronics disassembly plants and things like that. So it doesn't, in many ways, it doesn't follow the classic model of the long-term chronic bioaccumulation, which is why I think it's more the dust than the food. It's not to minimize the importance of the food, but I think when we first got into these compounds, people looked at these compounds, they said, this is dioxin. We're just going to follow the dioxin paradigm again. And I don't think that quite captures it. The second question is, how do the flame retardants get into the orcas? There's a real thing that I don't understand, and that is how, these compounds are downstream of sewage treatment plants. And they come into sewage treatment plants. We really don't know how they get into the sewage treatment plants. Because if you think about, if they're really using electronics and consumer products and things of that nature, the only way they can get into the sewage treatment plants is if they're like in your laundry and, kind of going through your laundry wastewater. It's really not clear what the linkages are between, your house and the environment in terms of getting this stuff out. So I don't know the answer to that yet. It really isn't any industrial production. I mean, these are only produced at a few places around the country, so it's not like you got every mom and pop operation is making this stuff. So I don't know the answer to the orca question. I mean, it's obviously coming through the food web. They're not breathing contaminated air. But how it's getting into their food, I don't quite know yet. Yes.
Maine didn't have one of those footnotes next to it, so do they have a safe alternative they found, or is not using flame retardants in their furniture?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it. I didn't look at the. I'm not familiar with the legislation in Maine, so I don't know. The difficulty with these sort of chemical by chemical bans is that if there are no alternatives and you still have the requirement for flammability in your products, then you can't have it both ways. I mean, there has to be safe alternatives, but you still have that. And they're not simultaneously retracting the ban. Putting a ban on the chemical and saying, we don't care about flammability. So it's still there. And my guess is they probably just move on to other chemicals. Yes?
Are there flame retardants used in leather products and things like that, or is it
leather product? I'm not aware of any flame retardants in leather products. The major uses are in electronics and in upholstery and carpets. And the padding of your carpets, the stuff that you're doing is impregnated with a lot of stuff. So I'm not aware of leather or sort of clothing. They used to put Tris. Tris was a flame retardant they would put in children's clothing. There's a big thing years and years ago for flammability, and it was bad. So to
how much data is there on urine samples?
There's actually a lot of data now on urine monitoring and also blood serum monitoring for exposure. The CDC is doing a major study as part of the Anthenes. They sample across the U.S. population, and they're now including these flame retardants in that monitoring. The urine analysis I've seen for these compounds, I think normally people look more at the blood serum than the urine, because it's metabolized and conjugated in the urine, but I'm not as aware of that. Yeah, in the back.
Is this the same type of frame of reference you got on qualifier?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to it. Maybe somebody here knows. I've always wondered when they, you know, what is that stuff? I don't know. Does anyone know what this?
Yeah. It's not, it's getting a lot more attention now.
Yeah.
They've been kind of off the hook, but now they're starting to get, we can start to go after them.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that, that'd be an interesting thing to look, find out. Another question?
Is there any kind of movement of just dropping these flame retardants altogether, or the benefits just outweigh the risk?
Well, there is a movement, it's really being driven by initiatives in California to come up with unfortunate word, but they call it non-chemical alternatives. The best thing that works is the aluminum oxide. If you just add enough aluminum oxide to plastics, then it prevents them from flaming. Now, there's a trade-off, because the things we like about plastics is that they're plastic, right? They bend, and you start losing some of the physical properties as you add these other additive compounds to it. So they're actually looking for trade-offs. What's driving it are the companies like IKEA and some of the other major furniture manufacturers are driving the market.